A single toy, laughing in the dark, isn't child's play. It's a whisper from an invisible threat. When 8-year-old Lily's vintage music box doll, Marisol, begins speaking in her mother's voice, saying, "Help me, I'm all alone," Emily Hartwell is sure it's a prank. But the moment Emily investigates, Lily vanishes. Now the toy's chilling voice is the only clue. Each night, Marisol repeats fragments of an unfamiliar lullaby, laced with a man's voice in the background. Emily races against time, tracing the doll's origins, uncovering underworld smuggling rings that traffic more than just antiques. As ordinary facades crumble, she finds sinister connections between harmless playthings and human traps. This is not a bedtime story. It's a countdown until Lily fades forever. Every whispered line from Marisol could either be a clue or the lull before horror. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Marisol Speaks. The morning had been calm. The kind of Saturday where sunlight came in softly, not blinding, but warm and familiar. Emily Hartwell moved through the kitchen in her slippers, humming an old lullaby her mother used to sing. Lily, her 8-year-old daughter, was in the living room, cross-legged on the rug with her toys. At the center of the floor sat Marisol. Marisol wasn't like Lily's other dolls. She wasn't plastic and modern. She was ceramic, her face hand-painted, eyes a shade too lifelike. Her hair was dark brown yarn, neatly tied with a pink bow that had faded into salmon over the years. She wore a little music box on her chest. A wind-up key protruded from her back, and when you turned it, she played an old Spanish lullaby, a tune neither Emily nor Lily could identify. Emily had found her at a garage sale a week earlier, the elderly woman selling her barely remembered owning it. "She came with the house, I think," the woman said, puffing on a menthol cigarette. Now, Marisol sat silently, her porcelain mouth closed, her limbs posed like a ballerina at rest. Lily loved her, far more than any toy she'd owned. At first, it had seemed harmless. But that morning, Emily heard it. "Help me," a whisper, garbled, a crackle of sound like someone testing an old tape recorder. Emily paused mid-coffee pour and turned toward the living room. Lily was still playing. Emily leaned in. "Sweetheart, what did you say?" Lily looked up, puzzled.
"Nothing, Mommy."
Emily frowned. "You didn't just talk into your doll?" Lily shook her head. "Number. But she talks sometimes. You just have to listen." That chilled her. Emily crouched beside the toy. "What do you mean, she talks?"
"She tells me stories," Lily said.
"At night, she said someone is in the dark with her." Emily stared at the doll. Its mouth hadn't moved, but the more she looked, the more unsettling it became. Not because of how it looked, but because of what Lily had just said. By evening, Emily had dismissed the incident as one of those things kids make up. An overactive imagination. She tucked Lily in at 8 p.m., kissed her goodnight, and turned on the owl-shaped nightlight. But at 2:17 a.m., she awoke to the sound of the music box playing. Faint. Distant. The tune slithered through the hallway like smoke. Emily rose, heart pounding, and crept toward her daughter's room. Lily's bed was empty. The window was cracked open. The curtains billowed with the night breeze. Marisol sat upright in the middle of the bed, legs crossed, head slightly tilted, music playing. And then, through the tiny embedded speaker, Emily heard it again.
"Help me. I'm all alone."
But this time, it was unmistakably her own voice. She staggered backward.
"No!"
she gasped. Her eyes darted to the closet, empty. The back door, open. The security alarm, off. Emily rushed through the house, screaming Lily's name, outside, inside closets, under beds. But she was gone. Gone without a sound. The police arrived within the hour. Two cruisers, a plain black sedan. Flashlights scanned the backyard. Officers combed the house. The lead detective, a wiry man named Detective Marshall Graves, kept glancing at the doll. "Your daughter's voice is in this toy?" he asked. "Number, it's my voice," Emily insisted. "That's the part I can't explain." Graves furrowed his brow. "Do you have a history of sleepwalking?"
"No."
"Psychotic episodes?" Emily snapped. "I'm not crazy. My daughter's missing, and this doll spoke with my voice." The detective nodded, scribbling something. "We'll collect it and have it analyzed. In the meantime, we've issued an Amber Alert." Hours passed. By sunrise, there were no signs of forced entry. No footprints, no digital clues. No surveillance cameras had caught anything. Not even the Ring doorbell had triggered. It was as if Lily had vanished into thin air. Emily refused to leave the house. While the tech team boxed up Marisol, she noticed something etched on the back of the doll's neck. Tiny letters, a serial number, and beneath that, an address. Not printed, etched, like someone wanted it discovered. The detective hadn't noticed. Emily scribbled it into her phone and waited until the officers left. Then, without telling anyone, she drove to the location. It was a warehouse, old, abandoned, downtown Charleston, near the shipyards. She parked across the street and watched. One security light flickered near the back entrance. A strange symbol was spray-painted on the side wall, a triangle with three dots inside. It looked like a code. A man exited the side door, tall, pale, shaved head. He carried a crate in one arm and held a phone to his ear with the other. Emily ducked. She watched as he loaded the crate into a white van. On the van side, faint lettering, Wren and Company, Vintage Restorations. That's when it clicked. The garage sale. The old woman said Marisol came with the house. Had that doll passed through this warehouse? Emily snapped a photo of the van's plate, then quietly drove away. Back home, she sat in the living room in silence, staring at the void her daughter left behind. The music box had stopped, but in her head the message repeated, "Help me, I'm all alone." In the coming days, Emily learned more. The van was registered to a closed antique shop. The phone number went nowhere. The address led to a storefront that hadn't operated in over 6 years. No digital records, no tax filings, nothing. But someone was moving items from that warehouse. And if Marisol had been modified, if someone embedded Emily's own voice in it, it meant one thing. They had been in her house. They had recorded her voice. They had planned this. She had no doubt. Lily's disappearance had started long before the night she vanished. 1 week later, something new happened. Emily received a package, no return address. Inside was a flash drive and a note. "Play me." She hesitated, then inserted it into her laptop. A video loaded, static. Then footage of Lily, sitting in a dim room, a single light above her. She looked unharmed, but her eyes were puffy. She was holding Marisol. A deep, disguised voice spoke off camera. "Tell your mother what you hear in the song." Lily whispered, "It's the same lullaby. The one you play for me when you brush my hair." Emily's breath caught. She had sung that lullaby only once, a year ago, on a night Lily had a fever. She had never recorded it, never told anyone. The lullaby had become a key. Someone was using Emily's own memories against her. And they wanted her to play along. Chapter 2. The Lullaby Code. Emily barely slept. The flash drive's video haunted her, Lily's puffy face, the tremble in her voice, the way she clutched Marisol like a lifeline. The doll had become more than a toy.
It was a transmitter, a messenger, a key, and someone wanted her to follow breadcrumbs, the lullaby. It wasn't just a trigger. It was a message encoded in sound. Emily sat on the living room floor at 4:12 a.m., laptop open, headphones on. The flash drive's video looped again. She listened closely, not just to Lily's words, but to the spaces between them. Background hums, reverb, static trails. There it was. A whisper behind the lullaby. Not words, tones. Three musical notes repeated, faint and strange, like a code embedded inside the melody. Emily knew she couldn't do this alone. She called the one person who still owed her a favor. His name was Aiden Voss, former audio engineer for a military intelligence subcontractor. Brilliant, paranoid, and perpetually caffeinated. He now taught acoustics at a small university and lived in a security compound-style apartment above a camera repair shop. They hadn't spoken in 2 years, not since Emily left journalism. But when she said, "Lily's missing, and someone used a doll to play my voice," Aiden didn't hesitate. They met an hour later at his place. "You look like you haven't slept in days," Aiden muttered, eyeing her over the rim of his cracked mug. "I haven't." She handed him the flash drive. He plugged it into a scrambled input port. His laptop was protected like a government vault, and dragged the file into a waveform editor. "All right," he said. "Let's dissect your monster under the bed." As the lullaby played, he isolated frequencies, ran spectrograms, slowed it down, sped it up. 3 hours in, he paused the screen. "Here." He pointed to a cluster of sound peaks layered beneath the melody. "That's not part of the music. See the structure? It's not random. It's mathematical." Emily leaned in. "What does it mean?" "It's a data signature. Someone embedded a digital payload inside the audio, like hiding files in a JPEG. Only this one's in a WAV file." He extracted the segment. "Give me a second to unpack it." 10 minutes later, a file appeared on screen. TAURM1.WMV. A video. Black screen. Then an image faded in. A grainy aerial photo of a building in the middle of a forest. The camera zoomed in slowly, revealing a weathered sign above the structure. Tau Rehabilitation Ministry, New Eden, Tennessee. "Tau," Emily whispered. "What the hell is that?" Aiden paused the video. "Looks like some kind of camp." Emily stood, her skin crawling. That wasn't a message. It was a map. "Someone's guiding you," Aiden said, "feeding you pieces like a puzzle." She nodded slowly. "Which means they want me to find her, but they're watching what I do." Aiden turned serious. "You're being manipulated, Em. This isn't a random kidnapping. It's a staged hunt." Before Emily left, Aiden gave her a burner phone. "Use this if you find anything else," he said. "Don't call from your number. They're probably listening." She asked one last question before she went. "Do you think Lily's alive?" Aiden didn't answer right away. Then softly, "I think this whole thing was designed to keep her that way. For now." The next morning, Emily hit the road. New Eden, Tennessee, 3 hours from Charleston. She didn't alert police. She didn't tell her family. If someone was monitoring her steps, she couldn't give them a chance to reset the game board. As she drove, she kept thinking about the message hidden in the lullaby. About how personal it had been. Whoever was behind this, whoever created that modified doll, they knew intimate details. They had studied her. And Lily. Which meant this wasn't about ransom. It was about control. She arrived at the Tau Rehabilitation Ministry just after noon. A chain-link fence surrounded the property. The forest curled around it on all sides like a dark moat. The building itself was a single-story structure,
more like a converted warehouse than a clinic. No cars in the lot, no signs of activity. She parked half a mile up the road and approached on foot. There was no sign of life until she reached the front gate. A security camera shifted to follow her. Then, the lock on the gate clicked open, as if she'd been expected. Emily hesitated, then pushed the gate and stepped inside. The inside of the building smelled of bleach and mold. Flickering lights overhead, empty hallways, no signage. She moved quietly, phone in one hand, the other gripping her pepper spray. Then, a sound. A faint melody playing from a room to the right. Her heart dropped. It was the lullaby. She crept to the door, cracked it open, and found a wall of speakers. Audio equipment stacked floor to ceiling. Dozens of dolls lined up on shelves, ceramic, plastic, cloth. All different, all fitted with small speakers in their chests. She stepped closer. Each doll was labeled. A L1-14, RM2-Titiknol-Tuju, LH-Tre-Tre-Null-N. And there, near the top row, LH-Tres-09, Marisol. Her hands trembled. This was where it was built. She turned on her phone's camera and started recording. Suddenly, the light snapped off. The door slammed shut, and a voice echoed over the speakers, distorted, mechanical, calm. "You're close, Emily, but you're not ready for the truth." Then another voice. Lily's. "Mommy!" Emily spun around. "Lily?" But the room was empty. Only the sound remained. Then silence, and a new message flashed on the monitor near the door. "You must remember the night of the fire. Go back to where it started." Emily staggered out of the building and ran back to her car. The fire. That night, it had happened 12 years ago. She hadn't thought about it in years. But someone else had. Because that night had changed everything. And it had left behind a secret she'd buried. Now someone was digging it up and using it to take her daughter. Chapter 3, Ashes and Secrets. The fire had happened in June of 2013. Back then, Emily lived in a small suburb outside Savannah. She'd just finished her first major expose as a journalist, an undercover piece about foster care corruption that aired on regional TV. It had earned her praise and threats. The fire was ruled accidental, faulty wiring, a surge in the basement. But Emily had never believed it. And now, 12 years later, someone else remembered. Someone wanted her to go back. She drove to Savannah before the sun came up. She hadn't seen the old neighborhood since she left it behind. Lily had only been a newborn when the fire happened. They had barely made it out alive. The house was long gone, replaced by a prefab condo development. But the empty lot next door, the one that had always remained fenced off and undeveloped, was still there. That lot had once belonged to the Rayner family, and that family had a secret. The Rayners were kind, polite, and unsettling. Emily remembered the first time she met them. Ronald and Evelyn Rayner, both in their 50s, impeccably dressed, almost too formal for neighbors. Their adopted teenage daughter, Sarah, had that vacant, emotionally flat look that unsettled Emily from the start. Sarah rarely spoke. When she did, it was often about her lessons and her retraining. She carried around an old cloth-bound journal she never let anyone read. And then, one night in May of 2013, Sarah had shown up at Emily's door, eyes wide, bleeding from the palm of her hand, clutching a page torn from the journal. "I can't go back," she whispered. She never explained what happened, just said they were going to reprogram her, that she had failed her obedience step. Emily had tried to call the police, but before they arrived, Sarah vanished. And the next week, the house next door burned to the ground. Not the Rayner's house, Emily's. That was the first time she ever felt hunted. Now, standing before the newly paved sidewalk, she could almost hear the crackle of flames, smell the chemical smoke, hear the sirens, and deep inside her chest, she felt something tighten. Because if Sarah had been telling the truth, if she had escaped some kind of program, then maybe the fire hadn't been an accident. Maybe it had been a warning, or a silencing. And now, a decade later, her daughter had been taken using the same kind of mind games. Emily searched public databases, old articles, archived records. No sign of the Rainers, no Sarah, no journal. But in an old court docket, she found a reference: the Tau Program for Youth Rehabilitation. And a judge's note that read, "Enrolled minor into phase 2 of the Obedience and Restructuring Program under Dr. Rainer's supervision." Dr. Rainer. Ronald. He hadn't just been a neighbor. He had run that program, and now she knew. Tau wasn't just a name from a doll's audio file. It was a real institution, a network, one that had gone underground after lawsuits, shutdowns, and scrutiny. But it had survived. In the shadows. And it had returned. Later that day, Emily received another message. A simple envelope slipped under the windshield of her parked car. Inside, a photo. Lily, again. Sitting in the same dimly lit room. But this time, she wasn't holding Marisol. She was holding the journal. The same one Sarah used to carry. There was a single word written across the top of the page. Prepare. Emily drove back to Charleston that night, her mind racing. Everything connected. The doll, the lullaby, the warehouse, Tau, the journal, the fire. She made two decisions. She would go public, reveal everything, use her old network of journalists to expose Tau. But before she did, she would find the last known person to escape it. Sarah Rainer. If she was alive, if she was willing to talk. Finding her wasn't easy. Sarah had disappeared from all records in 2013. No tax ID, no credit, no licenses, a digital ghost. But Aiden, her audio engineer friend, called with news. "I ran a voice print match," he said. "Remember that file from Marisol? The background whisper? You were right. There's a male voice layered under the melody. Can you isolate it?" "I did." He played it over the phone. A single sentence, spoken in a slow, calm voice. "You never escaped, Sarah. You just postponed your test." Emily's blood ran cold. Aiden continued. "I matched that voice to an old lecture uploaded in 2009. Psychology of Obedience. Speaker, Dr. Ronald Rainer." He paused. "The same Ronald Rainer from the foster care program you exposed. And get this, he's not dead. He changed his name. He's been working under an alias in Ohio, at a new facility." Emily leaned forward. "What kind of facility?" Aiden replied. "They say it's a private wellness retreat for teens with behavioral issues." Emily knew better. It was Tau, reborn. That night, she didn't sleep. She stared at her old research files, pieced the timeline together, reviewed photos, recorded audio. She reread everything she'd once written and the parts her editors told her to leave out. And then her phone buzzed again. A message, no number, just a file. Finaltest.wav. She hit play. Lily's voice. Software sleepy. Reciting something. "Obedience is love. Obedience is safety. I am ready to be loved. I am ready to obey." Emily's hands shook. The message ended, and one final line whispered through the static. "She'll forget you soon." Chapter 4. The Obedience Doctrine. Emily hadn't cried in days, but when she heard that final recording, Lily's tiny voice reciting a mantra of control, something inside her fractured. This wasn't just a kidnapping. It was a mental erasure. Someone was conditioning her daughter, slowly eroding memory, teaching her to forget, to obey, to accept captivity as care. And that meant Emily had less time than she thought. She met Aiden in a gas station parking lot off the interstate. It was raining hard, the kind of summer rain that smelled like ozone and rust. They sat in his car, windows fogged, files spread across the dash. Aiden tapped the screen of his laptop, zooming in on a still frame from the latest video. "Here, look at the plug socket behind Lily." Emily squinted. "What about it?" "That model hasn't been manufactured since 2008. And that wallpaper? Pre-2010. This isn't a new building. It's a converted one." He pulled up satellite images. "This is where I think they're keeping her." The image on screen showed an old schoolhouse deep in the woods of rural Ohio, once owned by a now-defunct faith-based group. "Want to guess what else is tied to that property?" he asked. "Let me guess. Rainer." Aiden nodded. "Bought through a shell company. I checked the tax records." Emily felt her pulse thrum in her neck. "Then that's where I'm going." He looked at her sharply. "You can't go alone." "I have to," she said. "They know me. If I bring cops, she disappears again." Aiden hesitated, then said, "You'll need proof if you find her." "Legal proof. Something irrefutable." She nodded. He handed her a pen-sized camera. "Live transmitter. It'll auto back up to my cloud. And this," he reached under his seat and pulled out a silver rectangle, "is an EM blocker. Disables radio-triggered locks and any RF-tagged monitoring on you for 20 minutes. Emily stared at him. "How the hell do you have all this?" "I used to work for people who made this nightmare possible," he said quietly. "Now I undo what I can." 2 nights later, Emily reached Ohio. The building stood in the middle of nowhere. Thick woods surrounded it on all sides. No cell reception, just endless silence. She parked a quarter mile out and walked through the brush with only a red flashlight for cover. The schoolhouse loomed like a mausoleum. Stone steps, arched windows, a rusted bell at the top. But the lights were on inside. Emily circled the perimeter. She saw them, children, through the windows, in rows, sitting, eyes forward, hands folded on desks, silent, still. A tall man stood at the front of the room. Dr. Rainer, older now, gray at the temples, but his posture, rigid and calm, was unmistakable. He didn't teach. He didn't speak. He watched, like a conductor before the first note. Emily crept around the back and found an emergency exit door. She activated the EM blocker, watched the red light flicker and die, then pushed the door open and slipped inside. The halls were lined with framed phrases. "Compliance is calm. Obedience is the first kindness. Memory is the enemy of progress." She moved silently, peeking into rooms. Every door held children, sitting in silence. Some blinked slowly. Others sat motionless, staring forward. It was like walking through a dream stitched together by fear. Then she found it. Room 14. The door was ajar. Inside was Lily. Her daughter sat at a small desk. Not chained, not restrained, but different. Her hair had been trimmed. Her posture was rigid. She stared at a blank white wall while audio whispered from a speaker on the desk. Emily slipped inside and knelt beside her.
"Lily," she whispered. "It's me. Mommy."
No response.
"Baby, I'm here."
Still nothing. Then, slowly, Lily turned. She blinked, tilted her head.
"You're not supposed to be here," she said softly.
Emily's throat tightened. "I came to take you home."
Lily frowned. Home? We already are home.
Emily's eyes filled with tears. No, baby, this isn't real. They've been lying to you.
Lily turned back to the wall.
The doctor says remembering hurts.
Emily leaned in, holding her shoulders gently.
Then let me take the pain, Lily.
You don't have to stay. She reached to unbuckle the bracelet on Lily's wrist, metallic, thin, barely visible. It clicked open. Instantly, red lights blared overhead. A voice boomed through the halls. Breach detected. Initiate lockdown.
Emily scooped Lily into her arms. The child didn't struggle, but she didn't help either. She ran. Down the hall, out the side door, through the woods. Her breath ragged, heart pounding, legs burning. In the distance, a horn blared. Then headlights. It was Aiden. He'd come anyway.
He opened the back door, she threw Lily in, and they peeled off down the gravel path as sirens wailed behind them. It wasn't over. Lily didn't speak the entire ride. She sat, staring out the window, humming softly, the lullaby. Only now, the lyrics had changed. She whispered them under her breath. Forget the voice that brought you here. Forget the love you used to fear. Forget the face that held your hand.
Forget your name! Forget this land!
Emily stared at her in horror. They hadn't just taken her body. They'd started to take her mind. And whatever they had done, they'd planned for the long game. Emily clutched her daughter's hand, silent tears rolling down her cheeks, and whispered,
I will make them pay.
Chapter 5. Unlearning Obedience. Lily wouldn't sleep in a bed. She sat cross-legged on the floor of the motel room, her back perfectly straight, hands resting neatly on her knees. Her eyes didn't blink much. She didn't speak unless prompted. And when Emily tried to hug her, Lily only allowed it for 3 seconds before saying, Physical contact complete. It was like hugging a stranger. Aiden had seen it before. He called it learned disassociation, a conditioning mechanism used in cult reprogramming and intelligence experiments. The goal wasn't just obedience. It was dependence. To make the subject feel unsafe unless inside the structure that had redefined their identity. They've rewired her instincts, he told Emily as they stood outside smoking cheap motel coffee. She's not resisting, because right now, she doesn't believe she's been taken. Emily fought back a scream.
How do we reverse it?
Aiden shrugged.
We need a disruptor. Something from her life before. Something so emotionally powerful it forces a contradiction in her programming.
Emily closed her eyes. She knew what it was. The song. Not the one embedded in the doll. The real one. The lullaby she used to sing to Lily when she was sick, afraid, or couldn't sleep. The one she never recorded, never shared, never published. She had sung it only to Lily. But now, Lily couldn't remember it. So Emily had to do something dangerous. She had to remind her. That night, Emily sat beside Lily on the floor. The TV was off, the room dark except for the dim orange bulb in the corner lamp. She took Lily's hand, gently, and began to hum. Softly at first, the tune rose in the silence, fragile like spider silk. Lily's brow furrowed, her head tilted. Emily sang, Moonlight hushes the sky above. You are wrapped in a mother's love. No more shadows, no more fear. Close your eyes. I'm always near. Lily blinked rapidly. Her mouth opened slightly. Then she whimpered. Just once. And pressed her hands to her ears.
Stop! She whispered. It's wrong. That's not the right song.
Emily paused. It is, baby. It's the one I used to sing you. The real one. Before they tried to erase it.
Number no, I'm not allowed to hear that.
Lily's voice began to shake.
That melody is disobedient.
Emily held her close, wrapping both arms around her.
Then be disobedient, Lily.
Just this once, Lily cried.
For the first time since her return, tears slid down her cheeks, and for that moment, she let her mother hold her. The next day, something changed.
Lily asked for cereal. She blinked more, laughed quietly when Aiden accidentally tripped on a charger cord. She even reached for Marisol, the doll Emily had kept locked in a storage bin.
Why do I remember her voice?
Lily asked.
Why does she sound like you?
Emily took a breath.
Because they recorded me without permission. And they used my voice to make you trust her.
Lily didn't respond right away. But then she did something that made Emily's heart skip. She reached into the doll's back panel, opened it, and pulled out the tiny speaker. Then she dropped it in the waste bin.
She lied, Lily said.
That same day, Emily contacted a trusted investigative journalist from her old world, Nico Park, who now produced long-form audio investigations for a major streaming network. Emily told him everything. Tau, Doctor, Rainer, the warehouse, the programming, the doll, the fire. She handed over audio files, footage, photos, the hidden journal Lily now slept with beneath her pillow. Nico listened for an hour and said three words.
I believe you.
But that wasn't enough.
We need a name, he added. Someone who escaped before this all began.
A primary source. A living survivor. Emily nodded. There's one. Aiden's search for Sarah Rainer had finally paid off. A digital thread, a ghost post on a trauma support forum under the alias Red Robe, contained language and phrases almost identical to the programming Emily had transcribed. Buried in an old thread from 2017 was this message. They burned her name out of me, but I remember the smell of lavender and salt. I remember a fire they blamed on fate. I remember a doll with no eyes. If anyone out there remembers Tau, you're not crazy.
We were real.
Aiden traced the IP at Columbus, Ohio, a nonprofit called Rebuild, a trauma rehabilitation center run by former patients of psychiatric abuse. And on the board of directors? Sarah Evelyn Rainer. 2 days later, Emily and Aiden drove north. Sarah lived in a modest one-story home. Tall trees lined the street. Wind chimes jingled in the breeze.
When Sarah opened the door, she stared at Emily for a long time before saying, They told me you were dead.
I'm not, Emily said.
But they're trying to kill what's left of my daughter.
Sarah nodded slowly. Then come in. You're going to need the truth. Inside, Sarah kept the shades closed. She moved carefully, like someone still expecting the world to collapse at any moment. She made tea, sat down across from Emily, studied Lily, who sat silently clutching her mother's hand.
They started the obedience doctrine in the early 2000s, Sarah explained. Before Tau, it was called the Lily Project. They believed the key to behavioral perfection was early mental realignment, changing how children defined identity, safety, and love.
Emily's mouth went dry. They called it the Lily Project? Sarah nodded.
They picked the name because it sounded pure, beautiful. But the acronym was ugly.
L-I-L-Y, learned identity, learned yielding.
They used that name, Emily whispered. Because of my daughter.
Sarah's expression darkened.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
That night, Emily sat alone in the guest room. Lily had fallen asleep, on the bed this time, snuggled against her side, the journal beside her.
Emily couldn't shake the realization. This wasn't about money. This wasn't random. They had chosen her. Her daughter? Her history?
The fire. The threats. The erased reports. It had all been preparation.
She had been in their crosshairs for over a decade.
And they were still watching. Still waiting. And the next move would be theirs. Chapter 6. The Architect of Control. The room was dim and quiet, but Emily could feel the pressure mounting like a thundercloud. Sarah Rayner had just dropped a revelation neither Emily nor Aiden had expected. Lily's name wasn't just an eerie coincidence. It was intentional. "They selected her," Sarah said softly. "Your daughter was targeted before she was even born." Emily stared, jaw tight. "Why? Why her? Why us?" Sarah held up a weathered manila file folder. Inside were pages, photos, transcripts, handwritten notes, Emily's old articles, her expose on foster care corruption, a copy of her hospital birth record, even her graduate thesis. "They were watching you," Sarah said. "Dr. Rayner believed your daughter could be the first subject to reach what he called total cognitive yield. A perfect case. A child raised with love and independence, then fully converted to obedience." Emily felt the air leave her lungs. "They wanted to break her because she was whole." Aiden sat in stunned silence. "So this was never about punishment or revenge. It was a controlled experiment." Sarah nodded. "Rayner sees himself as an architect of correction. To him, the world is disorder. Children raised with autonomy become chaotic, self-centered, unable to submit to purpose. He believes obedience is moral, that submission is the cure for all pain." Emily's hands curled into fists. "He turned my daughter into a lab rat!" Sarah leaned forward. "And now he knows you're coming for him, which means he's going to accelerate the final phase." "What's that?" "Severance." Severance was the final step in the doctrine. After trust had been redirected, after emotional bonds had been erased, the child was given a break event, a traumatic, orchestrated experience meant to cement the loss of their past identity. Once that happened, the subject would never return to their original self. It was irreversible. Sarah whispered, "Once they sever, she won't remember you. Not as her mother, not as anything." Emily stood, her whole body shaking. "Then we stop it, tonight." The team was small. Emily, Aiden, Sarah, and Nico, the investigative journalist who had agreed to go undercover to film everything. Hidden cameras, body mic, drone surveillance. The plan was simple, but risky. They would return to the Ohio facility. Not to sneak in, but to expose it in real time. Live stream the confrontation. Broadcast it to Nico's outlet, leak it to government contacts Sarah still had, because there was one thing cults couldn't survive: light and truth. They arrived at 2:08 a.m. The sky above the forest was black, moonless, silent. The building stood like a sleeping giant. But the lights were on inside, and Emily felt it in her chest. They were waiting. She approached the front steps, wearing a mic under her shirt, Aiden and Nico watching from the van, Sarah monitoring the stream. The door was unlocked. She stepped inside. No alarms, no guards, no children. Just Dr. Ronald Rayner. Sitting alone in the chapel-like hall, hands folded, his face calm. He looked older now, but no less terrifying. He smiled. "Emily, I knew you'd come." She didn't speak. He gestured to the pew across from him. "You came for her." "I respect that. Maternal instinct. Pure, biological loyalty, but it's misplaced now." She sat, teeth clenched. "Where is she?" "She's safe," he said. "Resting. And more importantly, prepared." He leaned forward. "Emily, your daughter is the most successful subject we've ever had. She recited the entire doctrine voluntarily yesterday. No prompts, no corrections. She even requested to have Marisol returned." Emily's stomach twisted. "She doesn't want that doll." "She does now," he said. "She wants what we gave her. Purpose, order, freedom from fear." "She's 8. Emily spat. She doesn't even understand what you've taken from her.
Raynor shook his head.
She understood chaos. She remembers crying in the dark, the fear of being left behind. We fixed that. We gave her stillness.
Emily stood.
Let me see her. He smiled again. I thought you might say that.
Two guards appeared. They escorted her down the hall. Not roughly, not angrily, just mechanical.
She was brought into a large room, familiar, sterile. One wall covered in a screen displaying a pulse waveform. Another held rows of modified toys. In the center, Lily, sitting upright, Marisol in her lap, her eyes distant. Emily stepped forward.
Lily, it's me.
Lily looked up.
Hello?
Emily crouched beside her. Do you remember the song? The real one? Lily didn't respond. Then, slowly, she opened Marisol's back panel and handed Emily a small slip of paper, written in shaky handwriting. Pretending. Don't stop singing. Emily's breath caught. Then Lily whispered,
He's watching. Don't let him know.
Emily felt tears welling up. Her daughter was inside there, still fighting, still holding on. She sat beside her and began to sing, gently. The lullaby. The one they'd shared before all of this. And Lily hummed along, out of sync at first, then slowly, perfectly aligned. The waveform on the monitor spiked. Raynor's voice crackled through the speaker. Severance protocol. Terminate now. Suddenly, the lights went red. But before anything else could happen, Aiden triggered the broadcast. Dozens of hidden cameras activated. Nico's drone rose from the woods, feeding live footage to a secure channel. Sarah fed documentation to every reporter, investigator, and digital freedom agency she had left. The world would see this. The doctrine, the programming, the doll experiments, the child conditioning, all of it. Raynor's voice screamed from overhead, but the guards didn't respond. Half of them dropped their weapons, because they were being watched now. Emily scooped up Lily and ran, out the doors, into the van, Aiden driving like a demon through the woods. Behind them, sirens began to wail, not alarms, police, FBI. The House of Obedience was burning, not with fire, with truth. And for the first time in weeks, Emily held her daughter and heard the sound she feared she'd never hear again. Laughter. Real. Warm. Lily leaned into her mother's chest and whispered,
Mommy, I remember you now.
Chapter 7, The Voice That Wouldn't Break. The van sped through the hills of rural Ohio like a hunted animal. In the back seat, Lily clung to her mother's hand as the lights of emergency vehicles painted their skin in flashes of blue and red. Emily had her arm wrapped tightly around her daughter, heart still racing, but her mind sharper than it had been in weeks. The lullaby had worked. The disruptor had reached through the fog. But this wasn't over. Not yet. Back at the schoolhouse, chaos bloomed. Federal agents swarmed the grounds. Drones buzzed overhead. Local law enforcement backed away as federal operatives stormed the halls, collecting evidence, rescuing children, and arresting staff. Dr. Ronald Raynor didn't run. He stood calmly at the front door, hands behind his back. When they cuffed him, he said only this, You cannot stop belief. You can only delay revelation. They placed him in a transport vehicle and drove away. But Emily knew men like him didn't believe in loss. They believed in waiting. Over the next few days, the world reacted. Nico's expose, The Doctrine of Obedience, went viral. It aired across major platforms, triggering public outrage and congressional calls for investigation. Terms like TAU, LILY, and cognitive severance became global keywords. Parents demanded answers.
Reporters uncovered a trail of funding tied to private foundations, extremist psychological institutes, and corrupt protective services. The footage of the doll lab, the children in rows, the whispered indoctrination clips, it shattered the illusion of normalcy. And somewhere in the center of it all was Emily. Mother, journalist, survivor. Lily didn't speak much for the first few days. She drew pictures instead. Crayon sketches of stars and forests, but also twisted toys, red-eyed dolls, and faceless men in white robes. Each morning, Emily would sit with her, coloring beside her in silence. One day, Lily turned and asked quietly, "Mommy, what happens to kids who don't get found?" Emily froze. She wanted to say something comforting, something bright and simple. Instead, she told the truth. "That's why we tell their stories, so they're never forgotten." Lily nodded once and went back to coloring. A month later, Emily stood before a congressional committee. Her statement was short. She described what happened to Lily, the recordings, the conditioning, the manipulation. Then she ended with one sentence. "There are still children whose voices are locked inside silence, and it's up to all of us to listen harder." Her words echoed across the room like thunder. But even in justice, shadows lingered. One of the surveillance techs reported something strange the night the facility was raided. The system had a failover loop, a backup server that activated when cameras were disabled. One file was recovered from that loop. A video, 15 seconds long. It showed Dr. Rayner sitting in a dim room, alone. He spoke directly to the camera. "If you're seeing this, then you've taken the bait. But the doctrine has already moved. Tau was never a place. It's a seed. And seeds grow in silence." The footage ended with a phrase burned into the final frame. A new name. A new voice. Emily knew what it meant. They would try again. New dolls, new voices, new lies. She didn't panic. She planned. She worked with Sarah and Aiden to create a secure foundation for survivors, one that would track these systems, watch the networks, follow the dark funding streams, shine light into every corner. They called it the Marisol Initiative. Its motto, "We remember the voices they tried to erase." As for Lily, she started writing songs. Not lullabies this time, but full songs. Verses, melodies, chords. She called them unbreaking songs. When Emily asked what that meant, Lily said, "They're the songs you sing when someone tries to break your voice." One day, in a studio gifted to them by an anonymous donor, Lily recorded one of those songs. It began soft, a simple hum. Then her voice, clear and strong. "I'm not a doll. I'm not a test. I'm not the silence you hoped for. I remember, and I'm still here.